Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, this is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Coming up, we'll dig into the GOP convention in our Week in Review, starting with presidential nominee Donald Trump's vision for America.
In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate.
Also today, should Boston's Black Lives Matter be working more closely with police and church groups?
We reached out to Black Lives Matter and said, we'd like to sit down and talk with you and share experiences. They refused to meet.
Plus, New England's long simmering feuds, like where to get the best fried clams.
All the natives will tell you to come to J.T. Farnham's.
Have you tried the clams at the Clam Box and at Farnham's?
Sure, they're good.
Odds are better.
Have you tried Woodman's?
I have. They're good, but I'm better.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. After a long, busy political convention week, it's time for our Week in Review.
Friends, delegates, and fellow Americans, I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
That's Donald Trump last night formally accepting the Republican nomination, capping off the GOP convention in Cleveland. And in his speech, which was more than an hour long, Trump laid out his vision for America.
My plan will begin with safety at home, which means safe neighborhoods, secure borders, and protection from terrorism. There can be no prosperity without law and order.
Law and order. That was just one of the themes of this week's sometimes contentious Republican convention. So let's turn to our panel to dig into some of those themes. With us in studio, fresh back from Cleveland, is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Deb. Nice to see you.
Also with us, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Hello.
Hi.
And Richard Tesei, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Hello.
Happy to be here.
So, Anthony, fresh from Cleveland, fresh off the plane, initial thoughts on this convention?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. It was a really, really interesting week. I mean, I've covered a few of these conventions, several election cycles. And one of the things in sort of the modern political world is these things, these events are so choreographed, they're so structured, they're so scripted, that sometimes it can be frustrating to cover them as a journalist. That was not the case this week in Cleveland. And it was fascinating. I mean, every day there was some new kind of eruption, some controversy. You had the floor fight on Monday. You had the controversy over allegations of plagiarism by Melania Trump. And then, of course, the whole Ted Cruz thing on Wednesday. Trump kept sort of appearing at odd moments throughout. We could never get enough of Donald Trump. And then, of course, the big speech last night brought it all home. So really, really interesting week.
And Arlene, you've been sort of watching things from here. What are your thoughts overall, and especially, reaction to the speech last night?
It has been fascinating. I usually have to force myself to watch conventions day after day, and this one's been a lot easier in some ways because it was more entertaining and more unexpected in so many ways. The speech from Trump last night was, he really had a bunker mentality, a sort of darker vision, if you will, of what the country, where we are and what we need. It was sort of more, I've heard it described as more the paranoid Richard Nixon than the uplifting Ronald Reagan version of it. But the thing that struck me the most about it was how, I hate to say it, but he sounded a little bit like a snake oil salesman selling an elixir, where he would list the fears, all the illnesses and the ailments and the problems, and the only solution he offered was the elixir of himself. It was very egomaniacal. The magic potion was me, Donald Trump, I alone can fix it, he would say. Who thinks that way? Far less even speaks that way.
Richard Tessé.
Well, I think this was obviously an unconventional convention.
Right.
And as a viewer, I was tuning in every night, not knowing what the heck was going to happen next. And I think the speech, obviously everything accumulated last night, and I think that the speech was pretty interesting. I think the way the delivery, I think, was a little unnatural for him. He's usually much more bombastic, if you've watched any of his rallies. But I would disagree. We're all analysts, and I think every analyst who has been watching this campaign from the very beginning has got it wrong. And he seems to have, would watch him and maybe think that he's bombing or he's way off the, going right over the edge, and people respond to him. So I'm interested to see. I was watching it with somebody very non-political last night, and they thought he was great.
So do we have it wrong because people are responding in a way that we don't expect, or what do we have it wrong?
I think that there are a lot of people who really don't want to watch a convention where everything's sugar-coated. And I think if you think the country is going in a good direction, yeah, and I have one opinion. But if you do think America's in trouble, you're worried about terrorism, you're worried about the $19 trillion debt, you're worried about the economy, about whether your kids are going to have the same type of life you have, and you feel as though this election is the Armageddon,
but Richard,
he was speaking
directly
to him.
Yeah, I think you're really on to something here in that I think what happens, that what we do as analysts sometimes is a completely different language than the folks on the convention floor or Trump supporters are thinking. I mean, I asked a question yesterday because I did a piece this morning about what some people said was a lack of serious policy discussion in the convention. And I spoke to a Massachusetts delegate, and he said, "We're not interested in policy discussions right now. We're interested in emotion. We're interested in a feeling. We're interested in when Donald Trump says we're going to make America safer, greater, and more secure again, that speaks to us. Don't talk to it." And I encountered this again and again and again and again on the campaign trail. I would talk to people, but what about his tax plan? But do you really think he has the experience? But what about, I'd ask those kinds of questions, and people would just look at me, and it's almost like, no, that you don't get it. That's not what we're focused on.
But
right
is
now.
That shallow?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's a profound feeling of dislocation, of losing control, of losing representation in this world. And there are a lot of people that Trump is speaking to.
I think you're both right. I think that he actually is successful in speaking at that level. I just thought he'd offer something more than the solution is me.
No, I
Donald
agree with
Trump.
I agree with you. I'm sort of in the middle about his speech, by the way. I thought he kind of brought it home in the sense was we finally had a night that stayed on script, right? And that was a good thing for the campaign. And he brought all those themes that he's been talking about for the last year together in a cohesive way. What I don't think he did was appeal to people beyond core Trump supporters. So in that sense, it might have been a missed opportunity.
One thing I want to do is just play a clip from his speech. Here's what he said about police and the strained relationship between police and the community, because I think this cut from his speech sort of touches on what we're talking about here. Let's listen.
I have a message to every last person threatening the peace on our streets and the safety of our police. When I take the oath of office next year, I will restore law and order to our country.
How?
Exactly.
How?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
This is
how, Anthony.
This is the question. I mean, here's the thing, and this is where I think the Trump people are sort of missing the boat on this one thing. Bill Clinton talked when he ran for president about restoring law and order. It wasn't his main theme, but he came up with an idea, and he said, we're going to allocate money, and we're going to put 500,000 cops on the streets of America. So it was a program, and he did it. And, you can debate whether or not it worked, but there were more cops on the street. I don't know what he means when he says, when I take office, I will restore law and order. How does a president do that?
I think it's the CEO mentality that he has enjoyed for much of his life, where he can just say, you're fired, or he can just say, you're hired. But the reality is, when you work in government, it just doesn't work that way.
Richard, you say this is what people want.
But on the other hand, we elected Barack Obama, and everybody elected him thinking this is great for the country. It's going to end the racial divide, bring everybody together. And here we are. almost 8 years later, and race relations in this country have never been so bad. And the president can do a lot, I think, with, you know, with race relations, but also with public safety, by just having a president who, you know, says, you know, yeah, everybody's civil rights are important, but number one, we got to respect the police. And I think there are a lot of people in this country who feel as though we don't have a leader right now who's not, you know, we don't have a leader who's really saying, hey, you know, the police is our first line of defense. We need to stand behind them.
Yeah, but, you know, but no one can bring the country together if the only thing they can say is, you got to respect the police. I mean, I take that as a given. They're there to protect us. We have to respect them. But that doesn't solve the racial divide problem.
And you take that as a given, and I take it as a given. But, you know, when you're an average American watching TV, watching police officers being mowed down, whether it's in Baton Rouge or in Dallas, the country is in a state right now where people...
I still want to know what he says, you know, when I take office, I will restore law and order. Is he talking about, for example, taking more guns off the street? I don't think so. Is he talking about arresting more people and making, you know, the largest incarcerated population in the world even bigger? I don't know. He doesn't say. Is he talking about raising money to put more cops on the street? I don't know.
But then again, what are we doing right now? And I think there's a void of leadership in the country, and he's stepping forward. We'll see how Hillary handles it.
I don't think that at all. I think there is no void of leadership. That the problems we face, the racial divides now, are not a function of a lack of a president who's not trying to lead on it. In fact, I think we have one who's trying to bring people together, but it ain't easy.
Okay, let's shift focus just a little bit here. Let's talk about LGBTQ rights, because this came up several times during the convention, last night as well, which, you know, in some ways is surprising, given the GOP's official party platform that was approved at the convention this week. That platform supports traditional marriage, puts limits on transgender restroom laws, and yet in his speech last night, this is what Donald Trump said. Let's listen.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
Did you hear what he said? You know, at first, some of my friends said, wasn't it great he mentioned LGBT, although he seemed to have trouble saying the letters, but at least he said it, and that was a good thing. But he didn't say he was going to protect us. He said he was going to protect us from foreigners. For goodness sakes, except for Orlando, the vast majority of LGBTs in America are not threatened by foreigners. The thing that threatens us are homegrown Americans who hate us because they're members of a religious right ideology. And that's what he studiously avoided.
Richard, say what do you say about that?
I disagree with that. I think it is important to point out that as a gay man, you know, if I was living in a lot of the Muslim countries around the world, I would be being thrown off the top of a building, and that would be considered par for the course. And, you know, and to wake people up to understand that we are living in a really difficult world, in a dangerous world, is important. But I got to say, you know, Donald Trump is probably the most pro-gay candidate that we're going to probably see nominated by the Republican Party in our lifetime. And the fact that two speakers before him was Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal and the original investor for Facebook, who stood up, very, you know, incredible entrepreneur, stood up and said, hey, I'm gay and American, I'm proud of it, and was well received. And there was another clip you probably have of Donald Trump saying, you know, I'm so glad and proud of the way he was treated. And it's just,
okay,
you know,
took
it's
my
not,
clips, Richard.
Okay, not, it's not perfect, but it's getting, you know, with Donald, I'd rather have Donald Trump than Ted Cruz as the nominee any day of the week.
And I have to agree. I mean, he is probably better than any other Republican nominee before him on this, but that he skirted around the very fact that the platform contains so many anti-LGBT provisions, and he didn't go near that. He spoke about foreigners.
Yeah, I mean,
do you make of that? Yeah, I just want to make sure.
Yeah, sure.
Richard, what do you make of that? That sort of division.
Yeah, Donald Trump is going to take the platform like everybody else does, like Hillary is going to do, and throw it in the trash barrel and govern, you know, put together their administration and govern as they see fit. Just like Charlie Baker did when I didn't go to the convention here, but there was an anti-gay section put in the platform. Charlie's been terrific on gay rights here in Massachusetts.
So. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I just wanted to sort of to follow up on what Arlene was saying. I mean, what I found interesting about that comment about LGBTQ rights is it was just another example of this sort of gulf that separates Donald Trump from the sort of far right wing of this Republican Party. And it was just emblematic of the divisions that we saw in the whole Ted Cruz event Wednesday night. On the other hand, Richard, I completely agree with you. You know, there's a lot of sort of excitement and debate and talk about this new party platform. And then it doesn't mean anything. It's sort of, as you said, it gets dropped in the round file, and the Republican Party gets expressed by the person in the White House, not the platform.
It does mean something, though, in terms of his vice presidential pick. You know, Pence did a really wonderfully funny, self-deprecating introductory remarks about himself in which he described himself as somebody that nobody knows.
Right.
The truth of the matter is the LGBT community does know him. We know him very well because he has a terrible record on LGBT issues as governor and as Congressman. And it ranges from saying that he wanted to take away money for people with AIDS and send it to conversion therapy so they can un-gay and de-gay people, or saying that he's against having equal rights, or saying he's against anti-discrimination legislation, or more recently and more famously, that his disastrous Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the one that says businesses can discriminate against us in Indiana. So it is threaded through not just the platform, but his choice for second in command.
And you know what was interesting about that is none of these debates came up. I mean, Richard, I don't know what you think about this, but when you think historically about some of these conventions, I mean, think about the way Vietnam was debated in 68, for example. I mean, there were these big issues. I mean, go back to 2008, the Iraq War was debated among the Democrats at the Democratic National Convention. And Arlene, what you're talking about sort of would have raised the possibility for, well, Pence says this, but Donald Trump says that. So how are we going to sort this out? And there was no sort of opportunity to air those differences, which I thought was a sort of represented a sort of paucity of public policy debate at this convention.
And I think it speaks to the fact that the Republican Party is a party right now that's in transition.
Interesting.
And in the sense that it's become much more populist. There are, you know, issues that Bernie Sanders cares about, like trade. You know, he's simpatico with Donald Trump right now. So it's interesting. Who knows? You know, if Trump wins, obviously he's going to leave an indelible mark, and the party's going to basically be where it's heading right now. If he doesn't win 4 years from now, I think you're going to see a lot of those fights play out.
I want to talk about some of the other things that happened during this convention. One of them we made brief reference to, and that's the plagiarism scandal involving Melania Trump and whether or not what happened with her speech and the similarities to Michelle Obama's 2008 convention speech. I'm wondering, do you think this story will continue to be a factor at all, or was it just a 36-hour news cycle story? Anthony?
I have a thought about that. So I think in that sense, Ted Cruz did a huge favor for the Trump campaign, because as soon as Ted Cruz declined to endorse him, the whole Melania Trump, did she crib from Michelle Obama or not, which seems pretty clear that she did, that whole story was no longer being talked about. So I still get the sense that this is something that is going to pass, even though it clearly wasn't a good moment for the campaign.
You know, I actually have a slightly different take on it than most of the commentary I've heard recently. I actually feel badly for her. I feel like, you know, she's not a professional. In a way, it really wasn't her fault. In her way, the campaign really screwed it up. Now, how they screwed it up is that they should have admitted immediately that it was a mistake, because people can forgive a mistake, instead of trying to blame the Clinton folks. You know, had they just said, you know, she likes Michelle and she likes what she said, people would have said, oh, well, that's kind of nice and kind
of
open-minded.
Well, could you really say that
and
get away with it?
The thing, though, that keeps it going, I think, is that on the Internet, there are so many memes that have been done about it that are quite frankly very funny. And I'm not talking about the mean ones. I mean just genuinely funny ones. You know, they'd have a picture of her pretending to answer the plagiarism accusation, and they'd have her saying, these accusations against my plagiarism in my speech hurt not only me, but they hurt my children, Sasha and Malia.
Oh, well, But I want to also talk about Charlie Baker. Skip the convention, right? Our governor, Charlie Baker, as did John Kasich, governor of Ohio. So let's talk about that in terms of political fallout. Richard, what do you think of that?
I think Charlie probably did the right thing. You know, he's never, from the beginning, when he was first elected, he said, you know what, especially having had Mitt Romney as a predecessor before him, he was very clear that he wasn't going to get involved in national politics. And, you know, he came, and I think he was smart at the very beginning to come out and said, I'm not voting for Trump, because every day he would have been asked about to comment on whatever Trump said, and his whole administration would have been engulfed in that. So I think he was smart, and people like him here because they do view him as, you know, a sort of nonpartisan governor, which I think is fine. Kasich, on the other hand, though, I think is a disgrace. And I want to just say, a very small person, because all he had to do is at the very beginning of the convention show up and say, welcome to Cleveland. I hope you all have a good time during the week. I'm very busy for the rest of the week. I won't be here, but welcome.
Welcome, and vote your conscience.
Vote your conscience.
Right, I mean, really.
And for him not even to pop in, and, you know, he held an event at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame down the street for the delegate. Mm-hmm. He couldn't just come in as the sitting governor of that state, regardless of who was being nominated, just to welcome. And I think I think he looks small. Probably smaller than Cruz.
I got to say, talking to a lot of the delegates on the floor, I heard, Richard, that view expressed a lot, that it wouldn't have been very difficult for Governor Kasich to just come in and say, welcome to Cleveland. On the Charlie Baker thing, the other thing that I heard was from a couple of delegates in the Massachusetts delegation was basically, Charlie Baker should have come. And he should have come because this is an opportunity for him to sort of speak up. And this is a great forum to sort of say, the Republican Party is also Charlie Baker. And I'm here, and I'm going to say this. And if it had happened early, maybe not in prime time, it's not like that convention would have been sort of demanding that he vote for Trump. Maybe he would have gotten booed. Who knows? But I think in the long run, I see the point that these delegates are making, that maybe in terms of the idea of the big tent that the Republican Party often talks about wanting to be, this was an opportunity missed.
All right. Well, we have just enough time now for hubbubs. Those are the brief stories that maybe weren't at the top of the news, not the headlines this week, but they may have caught our attention. Arlene, what's your hubbub for the week?
I found a piece in this week's Beacon Hill Times that spoke about the sale of the John Jeffries House, which is a beautiful historic building, a B&B, at the steps away from Mass General Hospital. I think it's owned by Mass Eye and Ear. The primary focus for the past several generations of this building has been to house patients who needed to stay near the hospital for long stays, or their families who needed to be able to visit them easily in an affordable place. So I don't know what its future will be, but there are a lot of people in the neighborhood who are going to mourn the loss of its historic and very real-world importance.
Richard Tessay, your hubbub for the
week. Okay, I don't know what people are doing this weekend, but I have a great suggestion. If you're looking for something to do, I strongly recommend the Stopping by the Revere Sand Sculpting Festival, which kicks off tonight, and it's going to run right through Sunday. It's in its 10th year right now, and it's grown into one of the biggest festivals in the entire country right now. The people who come from all over the world. I think 20 different countries are represented. Each artist is given 10 tons of sand, an 18 by 18 foot area to work in, and they can't use anything but sand and water.
And you've been before.
I've been there. They have 24 hours to do to create something. There are going to be fireworks. There are bands. There's a huge amount of people, and it's a really good take. So,
and you can take the tea.
You can take the tea right
to there. The beach. All right.
Yes.
Okay, Anthony.
Okay, so my hubbub's about some of the interesting things that happen that we might not know about at the many institutions of higher learning in this city. So MIT's Media Lab yesterday had a one-day conference on what it called forbidden research. Now, what that means is revealed by one of its key speakers. It included former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden, who's still in exile living in Russia. They beamed him in on a line. Speaking of Snowden, the most interesting thing about this is that the meeting announced, the conference announced this idea of a disobedience prize. It comes from the co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman. And the Disobedience Prize is described this way. We'll go to a person or group engaged in what we believe is excellent disobedience for the benefit of society. So that's my hubbub. I just like this idea of excellent disobedience for the benefit of society, all the ways that could be defined.
I like it too.
Well, I have one, and it's sort of sticking to convention-related news here. This is a study from the University of Pennsylvania, which found that people who have read Harry Potter books are more likely to have a negative opinion of Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. So this study said that the more Harry Potter books that a respondent read, the more the decline in that person's rating of Trump, who maybe they call he who must not be named. All right, so there we go. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, thanks. Safe travels to Philadelphia for next week's convention.
That's right. Thank you.
Also, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus.
Thank you.
As well. And Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts Senate. Thanks for being with us. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Some Boston clergy members and other prominent black city leaders gathered at Boston Police Headquarters yesterday to show support for police. They say that amid violence involving police in other areas of the country, Boston police have actually diffused potentially dangerous situations without controversy. But they also said something about the activists who criticize police, activists who work under the umbrella term, many of them, Black Lives Matter. Here's the Reverend Eugene Rivers and Pastor Mark Scott, both with the Azusa Christian Community in Boston.
We support Black Lives Matter when they do sensible things. Right. Pastor Scott and I, what was it, last Thursday?
We've been to every march.
Every march.
Every march.
In fact, we reached out to Black Lives Matter and said, we'd like to sit down and talk with you and share experiences. They refused to meet. Mayor Walsh invited Black Lives Matter to come to sit down and talk about the issues. They refuse. So if you can find them, you tell Black Lives Matter that the black clergy who work on the streets every day would love to sit down and talk with them and have a real dialogue.
We have two guests here in studio to talk further about this. Nino Brown is an organizer with Mass Action Against Police Brutality. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is the Reverend Mariama White Hammond, who ministers at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain and is also an activist. Mariama, welcome.
Thank you.
So I want to start with you, Nino, your group, Mass Action Against Police Brutality. How, first off, just so folks know, how would you describe how your group fits in with Black Lives Matter?
So my group, Mass Action Against Police Brutality, we've been organizing in the wake of the Ferguson Rebellion that happened 2 years ago, where Michael Brown was murdered by Officer Darren Wilson, that gave birth to this movement, protest movement against police brutality that has been called Black Lives Matter, Movement for Black Lives, what have you, the media, whoever has called it that. So Mass Action is, we are part of this larger fight against police brutality and state-sanctioned violence and terror. So we don't like openly say we are a part of a movement for Black Lives. That's more so a label that the media has, you know, slapped on any black activist that does anything, you know, in the streets. Because this problem existed before Ferguson, and all of us have been organizing against police brutality for decades, you know, before 2014. So, you know, we don't operate under that label.
So I'm just wondering, though, you are an activist for some similar goals here, and I do think that there is a shorthand, if you will, of calling all activists sort of working towards similar goals the same thing, and there may be differences. But I'm wondering what you think of what the Reverend Eugene Rivers said at this press conference, along with Pastor Mark Scott, about Black Lives Matter, not folks, activists who are protesting, not meeting with the police, not meeting with Mayor Walsh. Is that something that you would agree with? How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't know Eugene Rivers personally, but I think, you know, far too often the people in power want to bring those who are trying to change the power relations to the table so as to diffuse and pacify, mollify social movements, because that's how you destroy a social movement. That's how you pacify and get people to go back into their house. You bring them in to just, you know, calm things down, even though the tensions and the conditions are not changing. You know, Boston is still a very segregated city. There are still cuts to the budget to the public school system, whereas there are never any cuts to the police department. You know, so I think it's a smart move for any activist trying to change the system or to organize against police brutality to not meet with the police. You know,
so you wouldn't meet with the police?
Well, no, that's against one of our principles of unity.
Your principles say you will not meet with police.
Our principles of unity number 5 says we do not organize with police informants, past informants, MBTA officers, et cetera, et cetera.
But how would it improve then? I mean, you're an outsider. If you don't work with people, how can things improve? How can they change if you want change?
Well, I mean, I would disagree that we are not outsiders. We
Well, you're not within the police department, but you want the police department and the criminal justice system to change. But you won't talk with the people in those systems to make those changes. I don't know how those changes can happen.
I mean, just look at history. I mean, never in history, in the U.S. history of social movements, has substantial change been brought about that way. Our approach is to organize people on the streets because we think that power lies in, you know, these politicians, but that's not, they wield power. You know, that's not where power ultimately lies. It lies in the masses of people, the millions or thousands, if not millions of people who are affected by this issue in some way, shape, or form. Or see this as a moral outrage, what have you. So that's not a part of our strategy to, you know, to work with the people who have power, because the information, there's books and statistics, you know, so they this information is there. If they want to do the right thing, do the right thing. Enforce the law, you know. We don't need any more laws, because clearly there's a two-tier system, one for police and those who have institutional power, and then one for everyone else, you know. So it shouldn't be like that. That's fundamentally unjust. It should be, you know, if cops kill someone, brutalize someone, they should be doing time just like any other civilian, any other person.
I don't think that that's what folks are arguing with, but I do think that, you know, if there wasn't if the attention that there has been put on this over the past 2 years, I think there has been movement. And you know, maybe that's because of dialogue, because of awareness in a way. And I want to ask the Reverend White Hammond about this. You're not an organizer necessarily within the Black Lives Matter movement, but you have attended some of their events. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
And I'm a resident of Boston. I've been organizing around these issues. A youth worker for 13 years. I worked in a neighborhood where my young people were consistently profiled by the police. And sometimes in the process of working with them, I ended up being profiled too. So, you know, I'm here, and I was hesitant even to come because I think that you want to hear directly from BLM and from folks who are doing this work that represent that generation. I think I sit in between because I am an ordained clergy person. I am at a church. I know many of the players. I do know both Reverend Rivers and Reverend Scott personally, and many others. And at the same time, I have also listened really closely to and understand some of the frustration of young people who are calling out what the police have been doing. And sometimes I do think that there are real valid critiques, that there are low-hanging fruit that we know could be changed that don't always get changed, right? And so I think that there's a valid critique there. And I also think folks say they want a dialogue, and I think that's important. I do think there's an importance to having those conversations. I do think there's an importance to nuance and working out the details, because the devil is often in the details. But I do want to affirm the reality that sometimes folks don't get called to the table in a way that honors. There's a power inequity, and if you want to have authentic dialogue, you got to think about how you're going to do that without a power, or reducing as much as possible the power inequity that folks face in coming to the table. And to have the patience, right? One of the things I think I affirm and appreciate about, and I think Nino has raised this, and I think this is true, the Movement for Black Lives is an organization that has national chapters, but there are also many other groups who've been working on this. I remember when I was, you know, 1920, a bunch of our folks organizing cop watches. So this is not exactly anything new, and it's much larger. But
you know, Boston Police, some members showed up at this press conference mm-hmm. yesterday, and they said, they acknowledged, you know, we do have a history here, mm-hmm. a negative history here in Boston, and there were problems, but we are moving forward, and we're trying to reach common ground with the mm-hmm. folks who are concerned. Do you think that's happening?
You know, I want to be honest. Like, I think that there are some folks that are trying to take steps. It's the same way that I work with young people who got out of lockup and are trying to turn their lives around. Everything doesn't happen overnight. That being said, I do think there's a lot more work that could be done, one. I also think that a lot of rank-and-file police officers seem resistant to this work. So I think it's challenging because there's you know, the police chief, and I've had conversations with him. I think you can have an honest conversation with him. There's also the police union, and they're not always the same thing. So,
as we saw in Somerville this week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing for me, this is like a general life principle. When I see people making effort, I acknowledge that effort. That doesn't mean there's not a lot more work to be done. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think it's helpful to attack BLM or the larger police brutality movement in the media. If there's a conversation to be had, I think there's better ways to have that conversation.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we have to end this conversation. We are already out of time, but I do want to say that we did try to reach out to the organizers within Black Lives Matter Boston, but we did not hear back from them. So I want to thank both of you for being with us. Nino Brown is an organizer with Mass Action Against Police Brutality. I'm sure we'll have you in again.
Also,
Reverend Mariama White Hammond, an activist and minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Thanks to you as well. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, all sports have their rivalries, which we here in New England know all too well.
Boston and New York were always competitive in everything. You know, in a way, Boston had been the city of the 19th century. New York was touting itself as the city of the 20th century. And when the Red Sox were first born in 1901, in fact, Ben Johnson, the man who created the American League, he looked at the existing National League and knew that to beat the National League, to become more successful, he needed a big rivalry.
That sports writer Glenn Stout explaining on Vermont Public Television that rivalry, familiar to those of us here in Boston, the Red Sox versus the evil Yankees. And according to journalist Ted Reinstein, the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry is just one of many historic feuds here in New England, part of a long history that makes us unique. Reinstein is a reporter for WCVB Channel 5's nightly magazine show Chronicle. His latest book is titled Wicked Pissed, New England's Most Famous Feuds. Ted, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deb. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the Red Sox versus the Yankees. What is this one really all about, would you say?
Sox-Yankees?
Yes.
I think what's interesting about the Sox-Yankees is that although there is now over 100 years of a rivalry between these two baseball clubs, I think people who followed it for a long time, people like Glenn Stout, you know, they know that it is really about two cities. It's really New York and Boston.
Right.
The teams are kind of the proxies, you know.
But the cities. And how would you say it was able to, you know, get as rabid as it has? The cities certainly compete all the time, but this one is sort of notorious.
Right. You know, the funny thing is the history of the cities kind of prefigured what would happen with the two teams, because if you go back to all the way back to colonial times, Boston is the preeminent American city. New York is this, like, considered this violent backwater, you know, and then New York rises up in the 19th century, completely eclipses Boston, and so does its baseball team. So, you know, and in terms of what accounts for it, I really do think a lot of people would say that there's a certain amount of an inferiority complex. The Red Sox, of course, have always lost when it came to the Yankees until very recently, you know, when they finally won a World Series again. You know, you're going to be talking to Dan Shaughnessy. I don't know if it was Dan or if it was someone else, but called it, it's really the rivalry, to call it a rivalry, it's more like the rivalry between the hammer and the nail. For a long time, it wasn't so much a rivalry.
Let's talk about some other rivalries, especially within state. And you, mm-hmm. you spoke about, you know, the history and the American Revolution. We mm-hmm. have a competition about that. Can you explain?
At least two separate competitions that have to do with the Revolution, right? So, you know, Concord, Lexington, everybody thinks immediately that defines the history of the American mm-hmm. Revolution, particularly mm-hmm. for our area. Well, I always say when I talk about the book that, you know, England today, Great Britain, is America's closest ally, our closest friend. We always think of them. And I say, you know who's still fighting the American Revolution? Concord and Lexington. And they are. To this day, there is a bitter rivalry about which town actually deserves the mantle of birthplace of American liberty.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Still don't agree.
They
so,
still
yeah.
don't agree. The other one that relates to the period of the American Revolution that I did not realize, if you ask anybody who grew up in New England, where was the Battle of Bunker Hill fought? Usually they know it's sort of a trick question, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's Breed's Hill.
Grant's Tomb kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. What time does the 9 o'clock train to Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they know that it's Breed's Hill. But what I didn't realize, even having grown up in the area, is that the Breeds and the Bunkers, which are now in their 13th generation, they're still going at it. They're still going at it. The Breeds feel justly very aggrieved that the Bunkers got this legacy and this history that they don't deserve. And now it's social media is the battleground. And they fight on Facebook. They tweet at each other. It's a riot, except for the Breeds and Bunkers.
Yeah, not so fun for them. Another interesting story in your book was the rivalry behind the sometimes tense relationship between Eastern and Western Massachusetts.
Right.
That has long roots.
Right.
Long grudges.
Right. So you
can
know,
you explain that story?
I mean, I grew up in Eastern Massachusetts,
uh-huh.
And it really wasn't until I was, you know, going out on stories, you know, over the last 20 years in the Berkshires, Deb, that I would really repeatedly that comes up. And you may know that yourself, right? It comes up repeatedly. There's a real feeling that people in Western Massachusetts are forgotten about mm-hmm. by the eastern part of the state.
Right.
The Beacon, whether it's Beacon Hill, whether it's whatever, that they're forgotten about. And there's a long period of rivalry. In the book, I use as sort of the most stunning example of that is the militia that rose up in just after the Revolution and actually, you know, fought for, you know, getting out of some debts and so forth. And it was, you know, that was
violent.
And then
they went back to Western Massachusetts,
exactly.
went to farm, couldn't, and they had really high taxes.
Terrible debts.
And
were not forgiven.
They went to jail for not paying.
You got it. You got it. And, of course, the part of that that always seems so ironic to me, you know who rose up in the legislature and was absolutely the most unforgiving stance about it? You know, wanted them jailed and hung. Sam Adams.
Huh.
The absolute most, the biggest fireplug of the American Revolution.
Right.
Didn't like the idea of somebody else talking about the same issues of, you know, so.
Really,
yeah.
really interesting.
Crazy.
So I really want to make sure that we get in. I know you have lots of interesting feuds in your book, but we really have to talk about fried clams.
Personal ones too, Deb.
Yeah. yeah, personal, we've got family, but let's talk about.
But who doesn't?
Let's talk about fried clams, because I think that this is a really interesting story. And of course,
very
it's the time
feud.
Of year. It's the time of year.
Yes.
So explain the feud.
Right.
Because I didn't understand the feuds until I read your book. So
okay.
explain it
All
to
right.
us.
Now, let me ask. Do you have a favorite in that feud?
I'm not saying.
You're not saying. Okay. Uh-uh. All right. You're going to take the Switzerland stance on fried clams. So, yeah, it's Route 133 mm-hmm. on the North Shore,
right.
runs through Ipswich and Essex, is often referred to, especially up there, as the Clam Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three kind of iconic clam places up there. There's Woodman's, there's Farnham's, and there's the Clam Box. And they have legions of fans, and they have an ongoing feud for, you know, 75, 100 years now. In fact, it's 100 years this year that Woodman's claims to have invented the fried clam, which is only grudgingly acknowledged by the other two. But yeah, people are, you know, ask people, and they will divide quickly. People don't have a lot of ambivalence. It's like they're one of the three.
Right.
One of the three.
So what's your favorite?
Well, I am on very good terms with all three, and I'm greeted warmly whenever I walk into all three, and I want to keep it that way.
So you're also taking the Switzerland approach.
Totally.
So I wonder, you know, we're talking about some really long-standing feuds here. Is there something in particular about New England that, you know, makes this kind of a book possible where you can talk about these feuds and
right.
what's going on?
What's unique right. here? So that's a question that I you know, asked a lot. And my first answer is it's so there are some old feuds and New England is old, you know, and it's been around a long time. So there's a lot of time for grudges and disputes to fester and go on. Mm-hmm. I also think, though, that New England, the South is a little bit like that, but I think that New England is very, very protective of its history. It relishes, you know, its history. It's been around a long time. And it, you know, you've got, whether it's an institution, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a college, whether what have you, a team, you know, they really protect that history. And,
so it's protective, you know, not parochial, right?
It's both.
Okay.
I would say it's both for sure. But yeah, it's been around a long time, and there's a lot of time for these feuds to fester. And then when you add to that this sense of, you know, this history is layered and it's rich and it goes on and it's ours, and then they really, you know, protect it.
Hmm. So, and it makes for a great story. So what does this tell us? Anything we can learn? Anything you've learned from writing about these feuds, about, you know, lessons to learn here for the future?
I did early on express a favorite in the clam, and I learned very quickly that I should go the Switzerland route. So I've learned that. Now, I think that, you know, on the short answer is I found that as I researched these, that feuds are fascinating. People love them. It's a little bit like a wreck on the highway. It's like you feel a little bit guilty peering into somebody else's, you know, tsuris, as they say in Yiddish. But on the other hand, you can't look away. Mm. But the big asterisk with that, I would say, is that they're fascinating unless they're yours.
Right.
They're not as much fun if it's your feud. Just ask the Demoulas's cousins.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. Which, again, the Market Basket feud also in your book. Yeah. Well, Ted Reinstein, a reporter for WCVB Channel 5's nightly magazine show Chronicle and author of the book titled Wicked Pissed, New England's Most Famous Feuds. He'll be speaking about it in Sagamore in a few weeks, and there is more information at our website, radioboston.org. Ted, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Deb.
Tomorrow, a familiar Bostonian is headed to the Baseball Hall of Fame, not for monster hits or impossible saves, but for his work from the press box. Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy is this year's honoree for the J.G. Taylor Spink Award, a sports writing award named for the late editor of the Sporting News. To win, a writer must be voted in by the Baseball Writers Association of America. Shaughnessy will join the Scribes and Mikemen exhibit in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He's the fifth awardee with a Globe pedigree to do so. And Dan Shaughnessy joins us now on the line from Cooperstown, New York. Congratulations, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me.
So how are you feeling about receiving this award?
Well, it's the greatest award you can get in my profession, and I'm just thrilled to death and honored beyond all belief and very humbled by it and just joining the roster of guys who've gotten it.
And so when did you find out? How did they tell you?
You get a call in December from the Chairman of Baseball Writers Association of America, and there's some awareness that you're on the ballot and that you're being considered, and then you kind of hope that call is as good as it is, and last December it was.
And, you know, we mentioned earlier that you follow others from the Globe for this award. Peter Gammons, 2004 winner. He also grew up in your same hometown. So what is it about the Globe?
Oh, and Groton, Massachusetts, the population was from our children there. And so consider it a great thing to be placed. I went to the same kindergarten, actually. So Gammons led the path before me to Cooperstown.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, we're having a little trouble with your cell phone there, so I hope we can get you okay. I'm wondering, what was your favorite year to cover the Boston Red Sox?
Well, I think the two that they finally 86
2004, did you say?
Yes, that was a biblical event that no one will ever forget. 86 years, they finally in the corner on that. To me, that song was the most special year they finally won the championship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. It certainly was. And what about the 1986 World Series playoffs?
Well, that one really hits if you were a Sox fan, because they were so close and they waited 8 years at the point and looked like they had it wrapped up. But that night at Shea Stadium, you don't forget that, the events as they unfolded, and it was a horrible event that most people remember where they were or what they were doing when that unfolded on that fateful Saturday. But I think that them winning in 04 sort of got those guys off the hook, and they can walk around with their heads a little higher now.
Right. All right. Well, Dan Shaughnessy, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Tomorrow he'll receive the J.G. Taylor Spink Award, and he'll be added to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Congratulations again, Dan. And that's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend, and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.